Talmud Amud Bet.
I shall use the prerogative tonight to hopefully call the class a little bit earlier. I've been out the last 2 days, and I'm on the mend, but I don't want to press my luck too far. So I was happy to be able to come this evening. So my goal is to go to around 9 o'clock or so. Okay? We're on Kaf Dalet Amud Bet 24b1. The right side of the page, we have been discussing the birth of children, and that subject is continued here in the Braita, in reference to the Hesped, the eulogy, when it is appropriate to give a eulogy for a child. And keep in mind here that there are some basic obvious issues. First of all, what do you say about a child? Now, the child doesn't have a lifetime of accomplishments, so obviously the purpose of the eulogy is going to be largely to bring comfort to the family. So that's what's behind our remarks here. Rabbi Meir b'shem Rabbi Yishmael Omer. Rabbi Meir in the name of Rabbi Yishmael says, Aniyim b'nei shalosh, ashirim b'nei chamesh. Fascinating that there's a differentiation made between the poor and the rich. At a younger age, the age of 3, the child of poor people, you should give a eulogy for. Rich people, you wait till 4. And 5. Wait till 5, correct. Okay, we'll read to the end of the paragraph and then we'll reflect on it. Rabbi Huda Omer Mishmo. Rabbi Huda says, Shmo being probably Rabbi Yishmael's name, Aniyim b'nei chamesh, ashirim b'nei shesh. He disagrees. It's not 3 and 5. It's 5 and 6. Again, the poor people, you eulogize the child at a younger age than for the rich people.
And also, if they're even younger, you don't say anything.
Correct. Uvnei zkenim kibnei aniyim. And the children of zkenim, old people, are treated like the children of poor people. Amar Rav Gidol ba Menashe, Amar Rav, Halachaka Rabbi Yehuda, Shamar Mishum Rabbi Yishmael. The law goes according to Rabbi Yehuda, who spoke in the name of Rabbi Yishmael, and that was the latter opinion. That is to say that poor people 5, rich people 6, and that we treat the children of old people like the children of poor people. Okay? Now, let's see whether we can figure out, I mean, I think that to some extent it's obvious what the issues are here, why it should be brought up. I'm looking at the Rashi Ketav Yad, the Rashi manuscript, down, this is down on the left side, about 3/4 of the way down the page. It says, where can we start here? Where it says, Umehem Umahu Behesped. What is the law in relation to eulogies? Kamiyahe Gadol Shemitzvah Lahaspido. How old does a person have to be that it's a mitzvah to eulogize them? Aniyim b'nei shalosh, yipnei korach ruach shel ani. Because of the, the disposition of the poor person, shemitz the er al beno, who is more upset about his child, the death of his child, nina ashir, than is a rich person, lefi shebno misayi lo v'tzarich lo, because his child helps him and he needs him. Right? This is in a simple society. where the poor person is very dependent upon the number of hands he has in order to be able to make a go of it. And every set of hands has a value to it. And when the child passes, he feels it the way the rich person does, plus. Okay, plus, it's an extra loss for him. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Mishmo Shal Rabbi Yishmael, I'm still reading in the manuscript Rashi. B'nei Zekenim. Zekenim Mamash. This refers in all likelihood to real old people. Real old people. That must mean, you know, if it means that, let's say, if it means that, it means that these are old people who have children. Zekenim mamash, kivnei aniyim, are like the children of poor people. Lefi shelo ayu yecholim latzeit v'lavo, ubneihem mitaplim bahem. Because they can't get along on their own, the old people, and their children take care of them. So again, now, that's the analogy to the poor people. Old people are like poor people. They need an extra set of hands. And again, all things being equal, I mean, there is a sameness between the positions of the rich and the poor, or the old and the young, but the old and the poor have something in common.
But what happened if the old is rich?
I was going to say the same thing. You're an old rich person.
You could be an old rich person and we can buy the rent, so.
Well, then, I don't know the answer to that. Because partly, I'm not sure that this is what it means. I don't happen to agree with this interpretation.
Yeah. I thought it had to do with the beyond childbearing bearing age.
You can't have more children. You can't have more children.
That's correct. That's correct. That's the Yesh Mefarsh, in the English it says that, I believe, that the problem is that the old are worried that they won't be able to replace their children. Okay? The young, as terrible as it is, they have the hopefulness to be able to replace a child that has gone. But naturally that disappears with age.
And as for the young children, I just read something about 2-year-olds going out to the fields and doing this chore and that chore, but how wonderful this child was that he picked up all these farm chores.
Did you read that?
I think the Times or... I don't know where it was.
It's not in his helmet.
No. But in terms of life, it's true. Right. Young children can be very useful.
Absolutely. We're not used to that.
The fishermen in Africa, the young children.
Right.
That was
the
fishermen in Africa.
Sure.
Where did you read that?
In the
Times. The source of all knowledge, right?
I read that in between the helmets.
This is interesting. The you see it in other economies. Ours is the opposite economy.
Right.
Very much. So some of us have children who are adults.
Who are 40 years old.
Correct. And we're supporting them. They don't support us.
Well,
it happens.
I was thinking when you did the drash on Joseph and Jacob, the 17 and then 17. Taking care of each other,
uh-huh.
That's now gone from 30 to 30 on both ends.
That's correct. 30 to 30 on both ends. That's correct. That's correct. It should only last. It should only stop at 30.
Could you clarify who would say the eulogies if it's plural?
Correct.
And
well, let me just. I'll get to that in 1 second. It's a great question. The Yesh Mefarshim. I'm still reading in the Rashi manuscript. He concludes. Zekenim tomidei chachamim. The word zekenim may not mean old people, it may mean sages, which is true. Actually, that's what I think it means in the context. I think it means the sages. And I think it means the sages because the sages were by and large viewed as poor people. Right? The sages barely eked out a living, and the more they studied, the less time they had to really work, and therefore their children were of a value to run to the store and to pick up your wash or whatever you need, because it's another set of hands. also could be, but I don't think this is it, that the sages are around, have that psychological temptation to interpret it that way, that sages stay local. In the laws of sex, for example, the fact that a sage stays local means that the sage has to have more sex with his wife than a businessman, because the assumption is a businessman has to travel. So sage is local. The sage being local, then, the sage would have a continued level of contact with the child, which is probably unusual. It's probably unusual.
That goes contrary. Isn't the rich person supposed to have sex more than the
rich?
The wealthy man.
Not necessarily, no. Depends on what he does. Depends on what he does. It's not just a matter of money, it depends also on how you earn it.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
I think we had a growing story, and I don't remember who it was, one of the great Chachamim's, one or two of his children died, and that kind of had to do with going out.
The Rebbe Kiva,
And what he said in his parting words, right, I know you didn't come here to honor me or my children, you came to honor Torah and learning.
That's a Kiva.
Rebbe Kiva, yeah. So maybe this is related to that.
Mm-hmm, that's good. It's a good point. Good point. That it's the honor of the Torah. And that you're giving the eulogy. Correct. The presence, the heavy presence of the Torah simply changes all the facts of the situation and therefore means that there's a level of having to pay respect, which is just different. Let's get back to Barry's question. Who gives the eulogy here? I think the assumption is that, first of all, it's not the family. Which is, I say that it seems, had I taught this 15 years ago, you would have said, of course not the family would never give a eulogy. Today, most eulogies are given by families. It's a very unusual change that we've had in the Jewish community. I've witnessed it during the time of my own rabbinate. So therefore, one has to underline the fact that I think the assumption here is that they are given by others. Others, and it's not exactly clear who they would be. My assumption is that you're dealing with the sages, but you don't have a clergy the way we think of a clergy.
Right.
You don't have it.
No rabbi.
Correct. This concept we have of the ministering of the clergy in at events like that, I think is something that's just a very modern idea. Probably even an American idea. I don't really know.
But in the and at least the commentary suggests that it was to for the family bring comfort to the family. And so then I'm wondering whether or not the eulogy was specifically about the deceased or whether or not it was framed in the context of bringing comfort to the family.
The eulogy, there are two theoretical almost two theological ideas behind eulogies. One is bechi, weeping, and one is nechama, comfort. They're not the same.
The what is the second?
Nechama. They're not the same. And they could actually be in tension with each other. That's always a challenge in giving a eulogy. The death of a child, for example. You don't want to, you don't want to increase the level of grief. Instead, what you want to do is to find something of comfort. Frequently, when you're dealing with a child, you essentially end up spending at least half your time not about the child and not about the family, but about how to think about what's happened. Which in effect is to bring comfort. It's in effect to bring comfort. So I think that that's so often what you really see your role is doing, and I think that's what their understanding of it is. It's directed at the family.
Have we had any Ulysses come down to us from?
In part. We don't have full eulogies as we would think of them, and I assume that the eulogies were much fuller than what we have. What we have are verses that were recited with poignancy. You know, poignant verses that were recited at the death of so-and-so or so-and-so, or a short statement that was made, or a story that is told. You have something like that. It's hard for me to imagine that in real life the eulogies were not extended beyond that. We do have those kernels there.
I know nothing about the economic realities of the time, but the fact that we're dealing with only two categories here, does that probably reflect that people pretty much at the time were either rich or poor and there was no one in the middle? And who made the determination?
But stuff like this that was the grist for the late Professor Finkelstein, Louis Finkelstein, in his book on the Pharisees, analyzed the rabbinic world in terms of the rich and the poor. It was a way to think in general in the modern world. It was a way to think in terms of the Roman world, and this was a piece of the Roman world that we're talking about, where you have, just think of your how would you speak of Roman society, our patricians and plebeians. No concept of anything in the middle, and I don't know what that means. I'm not surely not an economist nor a historian of the economy. So here I think that this is classic. In a way, it could be that this is symbolic. Rich and poor could perhaps be symbolic of, well, on the one hand, plebeians, patricians. On the other hand, as Finkelstein would describe them, they would be Pharisees or Sadducees. The Sadducees being a more patrician group of people in the population. And of course, the Pharisees, either the Canaan, who are the Anis. So that would all fit with the sociology of Finkelstein. This was the nature of the population. To some extent, also it reflected where people lived. The farmers and the city, the urban people. The farmers being a cut below in that particular society, the urban people, because of the city of Jerusalem and the urban nature of it, and the fact that money had to come into it all the time, was a place where people were at a greater level of wealth, for what it's worth.
And just back on the question of if the elderly mean really the elderly, what was life expectancy
then? Life expectancy was the same as it is today. Well, life expectancy in terms of if you survived childhood,
uh-huh.
it was well, today's a little longer, but it was essentially 70.
Oh, for men and women?
No, I don't know that. That's correct. So it's not what we think. You know, we tend to think they must all die at 40. That's one of the reasons that I don't think that I have trouble with the Canaan giving. You're tempted to think that when you read this, because you say the Canaan having children, well, they were probably 35, 40 years old, called the Canaan. You know, could be. I don't think that's what it is. That's one of the reasons that I don't think that is because I know that the life expectancy from all the evidence in the Talmud is the life expectancy was 70. If you died at 60, it was considered a premature death.
Hmm.
Which is not to say that the average would be that, because so many people died in youth and in early childhood. But if you could make it through there, then you had a good life expectancy.
Well, it could be an older man with a young woman.
That's so true. That's so true. Yeah. Good. Okay. Okay, now we're going back to the subject with which we began before we got into the Baraita. And that was the question of the effect of Yom Tov on Shiva and on Shloshim. Remember, that's what we did last time. We studied the Mishnah. We went back to the earlier Mishnah to come back now. And the Mishnah said that the arrival of the holiday will cut off Shiva and it will cut off Shloshim. And I explained to you the logic behind that. The logic behind the cutting off the Shiva was, if it would continue, right, there's no way that you could finish it anyway, because the holidays are 7 days long. If we're talking about two of the three pilgrimage festivals, they're 7 days long. So in effect, just because of the number of days in the holiday, effectively it cuts it off. But then we saw in the Mishnah that Rabbi Gamliel said, and there was an argument about the days, other days. Number one was Shavuot. Shavuot was an argument, because Shavuot in the Bible and in the land of Israel is one day. So even if what I said logically is true for Sukkot and for Pesach, you have to wonder whether it will carry over as well to Shavuot. And then we learned one opinion is yes, of course, and one opinion is no. The opinion that was yes justified it additionally because on Shavuot there were 6 days after Shavuot which were days of Tashlume Korbanot. If you didn't bring your Korban Chagiga, the festal offering, on the festival itself, you had another 6 days, that is to say a total of 7 days in which to do this. So in its own way then, Shavuot became comparable, even if not exactly comparable, more comparable to Sukkot and Pesach. And that was, according to one of the points of view, why it was that it would be treated like Sukkot and Pesach. But that still leaves us now with two other days, namely Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. They are festivals. And we have to figure out, in fact, how they are treated. We saw in the Mishnah there were two points of view. One, that Rosh Hashanah, oh, I should go back, even Shavuot, we saw there was another question in the Mishnah, because Shavuot, the Mishnah also said after the destruction of the temple, Shavuot should be treated like one day, because there's no longer a possibility to bring the sacrifices for the 7 days. So therefore, we should change it. Other point of view is, you don't change things like that. Once it is, and we continue the practice the way it was. That still leaves us the question of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Okay? Let's just, quick background to where we are now. Darash Rabbi Anani Bar Sason Afika Debei Nesia. Now, take seriously the structure of this. Rabbi Anani Bar Sason Darash, he interpreted. At the entrance to the Nasi's house, the Nasi, remember, like Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the Nasi was the intellectual and the political leader of the land of Israel in those days. Okay? You had one leader who embodied both.
And wasn't he a religious leader too?
Yes, a religious leader as well. Was not always the case.
What?
It was in the period before that, the period of Hillel and Shammai, those jobs were separated. There was an Av Beit Din and a Nasi. But by the time of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, it becomes the same. So this is happening at Beit Nasiya, at the Nasi's house. He's interpreting at the entrance. Yom Echad Lifnei Atzeret. No, first of all, that's interesting. The political leader has a rabbi who is standing at the entrance teaching Torah. I mean, just the picture is an interesting picture. They're transferred a little bit. You know, to what extent is one comfortable with images like that? But that's the image here. Right? And what is he teaching? Yom Echad Lifnei Atzeret Va'atzeret Arei Kam Arba'a Asar. Okay. If you have a burial that's one day before Atzeret, remember what Atzeret is? Atzeret is Shavuot. one day before Shavuot. Okay? Shavuot cuts it off. Therefore, simply with 1 hour or 1 minute of Shiva, you have observed 7 days of Shiva. Now we're learning how to count the Shloshim. Okay? So, the 1 minute of Shiva that's before the holiday gives you 7 days. Then Shavuot itself.
7 days too.
Shavuot is 1 day, but 1 day which counts as 7 days. Okay. All of this now is where we came from, that if we're going to treat Shavuot in fact like Pesach and Sukkot, then in fact it's consistent. And it will be treated exactly like that. So the day after Shavuot, you've already observed now 14 days.
And this is after 1 minute and 1 day.
That's after 1 minute and 1 day.
This is a good discount.
Okay, good. Yeah. Exactly that. Exactly that. Okay? So that is now that's the law. Okay? Shama Rabbi Ami the Ikfat. Rabbi Ami heard what Rabbi Anami had taught, and he was mad. He was mad. Amar, Atu Didei Hi, he said, is it his own interpretation? The Rabbi Elazar, Amar Rabbi Oshaya Hi. This rather is the teaching of Rabbi Elazar, who said in the name of Rabbi Oshaya. So he wasn't mad about what he taught. He agreed with the point of view, for what we would assume. What he was mad about was the nature of the transmission of the tradition, that he said it in his own name. Now, I can understand that immediately. He was standing at the door of the president's house. So he was taking advantage of the opportunity. He's in a place of political importance. He's carried away by the politics of the whole thing. Right, suddenly, when in a more sober environment, he would have said, anyway, I teach in the name of Rabbi so-and-so, Rabbi so-and-so, Rabbi so-and-so. He just thought it as if it were what he had to say. Okay? So it's my sense of the blind nature of political environments. Now, notice that the Gemara goes on and tells exactly the same story in nearly exactly the same words, but it takes place in Babylonia and not in the land of Israel. Darash Rabbi Yitzhak Nafcha. Rabbi Yitzhak Nafcha taught Akil the Resh Galuta. On the porch of the Resh Galuta. The Resh Galuta was the counterpart in Babylonia.
Rosh HaGalut.
Rosh HaGalut. He was Rosh HaGalut, and there it meant political. There was never a unity between the political and the intellectual in Babylonia, whereas there wasn't the land of Israel. It never happened in Babylonia. In Babylonia, you had the rabbis, and you had the Resh Galuta. You never had a Resh Galuta who was identified with the rabbis. Okay, so here, this is clearly a totally political situation. This Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha is on the house, on the whole porch of the house of the Resh Galuta, and he says, Yom Echa Bifnei Atzeret Da'atzeret Harei Kan Arba'a. One day before Shavuot and Shavuot add up to 14 days of the Shlosh. And here's a different rabbi hears. Shama Rav Sheshet Ikfat. Rav Sheshet hears and he gets mad. He gets mad. Amar Atu Didei Hi. And does he mean to say it's his idea? The Rabbi Elazar Amar Rabbi Oshaya Hi. This is the teaching of Rabbi Elazar, who taught the teaching of Rabbi Oshaya. And of course, then the Gemara goes on and teaches us what that was. V'yamar Rabbi Elazar Amar B'Rabbi Yoshaya Minayim Yatzeret Sheyesh La Tashlumim Kol Shifa. Where do we learn in the Bible that there are a total of 7 days of Tashlumim, when you could in fact bring the sacrifice that you hadn't brought on the first day? Shenemar v'chag ha-matzot v'chag ha-shavuot v'chag ha-sukkot. It says on the three pilgrimage festivals, chag ha-matzot, chag ha-shavuot, and chag ha-sukkot. Okay? Ma chag ha-matzot yesh la-tashlumim kol shifah. Just as chag ha-matzot, the festival of matzah, has tashlumim, namely that you could bring the chagiga for the entire festival for 7 days. Tashlumim kol shifah for 7 days. Af chag ha-shavuot yesh la-tashlumim kol shifah. The same is true for chag ha-shavuot, that there is a compensatory period of 7 days when you could bring the sacrifice, which means then that it is treated, the day then becomes treated according to the laws of mourning as if it were 7 days. Okay? Now comes the more complicated question. Adbere Rafapa Rav Avya Sava Vidarash. These stories are all stories that have a little bit of color to them, the actual environments in which they happened. The last two, you see actually where the teaching went on a porch, went on in front of a doorway, and there's an interplay here of the transmission of tradition. Oh, let me just say a word about that. Keep in mind the anger of these rabbis. I don't really know how to judge that. Is it, part of me says it's the political. They just see what goes on when you move rabbis into the frame of politics. When they get on the porch or at the door of political leadership, they don't like what happens. They don't like what happens. So part of me says that. Part of me says it has nothing to do with that, and it's just an example of the nature of oral tradition. And the oral tradition is such that it has to be carried, transmitted properly. And every once in a while you will see people reacting when there is an improper transmission of the oral tradition. And this is just some, you know, an example of that, where you see it, and you see it in two contexts. You see it both in Babylonia and in the land of Israel. But I still like my first explanation better. But I'm not sure it's right.
I think in the context it makes more sense to me, because why take this particular story to illustrate the point that there are mistakes made in the oral tradition and by parroting the story in those two distinct communities?
That's something to me. You've got two completely different communities, or more or less different communities, with a similar institution in them. And both these things and the criticism for the recitation in an identical situation, I think it lends itself to the political interpretation.
Is there a time gap between the Israeli community and the Babylonian community?
It's roughly contemporary.
Both in the same time?
Yeah, they're both.
So the Galut and the life of Israel were in the same time?
Correct. Yeah. Sure. The Galut went on from 586 BCE. There was a Babylonian Jewish community that had been established. 586 BCE. So that by the time we get to the rabbinic period, Hillel, remember where Hillel was born? Babel. Hillel was born in Babylonia and only came to the land of
Israel. The Jews were in Israel from where they came. Because the Galut started. Okay.
They came back with Ezra and Nehemiah.
With Nehemiah.
Right, Ezra and Nehemiah. They came back to the land of Israel.
So why not the whole galut came back? Why just?
You know why? Read the book of Ezra.
You ask my wife.
Because they had wives like your wife.
So that's because of my wife.
Okay. Some said it was their wife, and the wife said, "It's my husband."
You can say it's my wife.
Okay.
That is no problem.
I'm not saying in your position. I just don't want us to generalize.
No, but that was the reason. That
sure, the reason was that they were making too much money in Babylonia. That they had a good life. They didn't want to come back. That's what the Bible says. Yeah?
Even after the destruction of the first temple, not literally everyone left. I mean, there was still
correct.
A
There were.
Yeah, there was always a little
group
that I understand. But, I mean, that was a
but the leadership, the main piece of the community, the leadership all left. They left, went to Babylonia, and they didn't come back. They came back 70 years later. I mean, it's not as if they came back a million years later. They came back 70 years later. And it took time then, because you're dealing roughly the year 500. If we go 500 to zero, that's 500 years. That's a pretty good time. Look. My family is in America a little over 100 years. A little over 100 years. So we're newcomers. Newcomers. And I've even seen that we're old in America compared with so many other families. Back much less time than then. So it's interesting.
Very interesting.
Interesting. Interesting. And realize that the community in Babylonia
was bigger, I think.
Existed until the 1950s.
Yeah. 1950-51.
Yeah.
There's a book and all sorts of writings about how they were actually gotten out.
Yeah. It was as a result after the founding of the State of Israel. We're going to show a movie on this a few Thursdays from now. This movie on put out by the Abraham Project. It's on the Jews of the Sephardi lands and their diaspora. And what happened after the founding of the
state? Called Operation Magic Carpet.
Well, Magic Carpet
was
Yemenite. That was Yemenite, particular. I happen to be reading. I'm reading a book now. What are you referring to?
This particular, the Jews came back from Babel, I think it's not project, but something Ezra, for that reason.
Are you talking modern times?
Yeah.
Talking modern times.
I don't remember.
But just it's important to keep in mind the continuity of that community. I don't believe there was another Jewish community anywhere in the world that had such a great level of continuity as that community. Only now are you beginning to read, because it's now two generations later. The grandchildren of those people, the children and the grandchildren, are now writing books about that community. The people themselves didn't want anything, they couldn't do that. Now the children and the grandchildren. I'm reading a book now written by the Israeli rabbi who I know some of you have read, Chaim Sabato.
Mm-hmm.
Chaim Sabato, his latest book was called Ka'afa Pe Shachar. It is, to my mind, if this guy doesn't get the Israel Prize for this book, Ka'afa Pe Shachar, it is unbelievable, this book. It is a masterpiece. Absolutely one of the great pieces of Hebrew literature. Ka'afa Peshacha.
What does that mean?
It means as the eyelids of the morning. The eyelids of the morning. He describes one chapter in the book where he describes an immigrant from Halab. Well, Halab is Syria, but it was the same community. This is recent. The community of Halab had they had minagim where they recited poetry, and they always recited poetry. and every holiday or every Shabbat there was specific poetry, and they were all little children, were experts in the poetry of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. And therefore the scholars came out of that community, and because they grew up reciting poetry, and they had continuity from the 11th century, and they, all of them, knew the importance of poetry. I mean, there are, the closest thing you have was, for a while, the German Jewish community did that, but it got lost, basically. It got lost among the German Jews. There was great German Jewish poetry written in the 12th century. We still have some of this in our prayer book. The greatest poetry is written by the Spaniards. Spanish Jews. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, Ibn Gabir, all the Ibn Ezra. And as living poetry, it was kept in that part of the world. They're the ones who taught their children that. And the children grew up in the synagogues, they grew up and they sang it and they knew the melodies for it. And they were the only people in the world, only Jews in the world. Just now, their children are beginning to write about these things.
Very important genetically also, because they represent what's left of the original gene.
Probably true.
Sure. And so, actually, some of my studies have been in that population.
Is that right?
They have a relatively high frequency of recessive disorders, genetically inherited recessive disorders, some of which have to be.
Because of this in there, tremendous endogamy in the community?
Yeah, they've intermarried over from 586 BCE until the present day.
Right.
Obviously, less since 1950-51 when
right.
they reached Israel, but still, I think the community is still reasonably tight-knit from a marriage standpoint. So, everybody knows there are a lot of diseases in Ashkenazi Jews, but by comparing whether or not those mutations also occurred in the Iraqi Jewish population, which is what their modern designation is, you can tell exactly when the mutation occurred.
Interesting.
And so you have what we call founder effects, and the Ashkenazic population clearly went through some very, very narrow bottlenecks where the population was very narrow. So the Iraqi Jewish population is actually a defining population in terms of the genetic study.
Fascinating. Very interesting. Very interesting. Okay.
Was there actually a rule about in written, tradition, you have footnoting and you always give credit to people? Is that part of the point of this? It's very important to always give credit to the original person who said something.
To some extent, yep.
It's almost like footnoting.
Correct.
You know?
That's why I don't do it because I find it pretentious, but there are rabbis who do it. You'll find this among Orthodox rabbis who in their sermons always with the same phrase. The phrase is Yavo Goel Tzedek Mashiach Tzikenu B'meravi Amenu Amen. And what that literally means is, may the Messiah come, the Messiah, the righteous one, please come speedily, please, in our day, amen. So it's a nice way to end a sermon, and there are rabbis who end all of the sermons that way. The reason for that is the rabbinic teaching that the Mashiach will not come if you don't quote the rabbis properly. So the reason this became a tradition to add at the end of a sermon was that you hope that you've given everybody who deserves credit for a quotation proper credit, in which case then the Mashiach will be able to come. So in fact there is this tradition of the scholarly apparatus, as it were, even though it's not the same thing. It does go way back, and you can see that in the story too. Okay.
Yes, I think so. The Gemara presents a similar ruling as regards to Rosh Hashanah.
Okay. Adbere Rav Papa Rav Avya Sava Vidarash. Rav Papa led Rav Avya Sava. That's a nice image there. Sava is like in modern Hebrew you have the word Saba. Saba means grandfather. But in the Talmud it means old person. Talmud means Saba means an old
father
person.
Father is an old person.
Correct. And that's why in the Talmud also, in classical Hebrew, in Hebrew in the Talmudic period, Zaken also means grandfather. Or Zakena, Zakenati.
Sabim the Sabatot.
What?
Sabim.
Sabim.
The Sabatot.
Sabatot, grandmothers.
Grandparents, but it's all, in language, it's all different.
Correct. It actually means all people. And it says, if, it's a nice image. I don't know what the source of the English image of grand. That's not a bad idea. Grandparents. Sounds like a good image. But here it's the Zakein Shali. Zakeini. In other words, there may be lots of old people, but this is my old person. This is my old person. Okay? And that's the relation of grandchild to grandparent. So here, he was leading, Rav Papa was leading Rav Avya, the old one, Vidarash, and he was teaching at the same time. Yom Echad Lifnei Rosh Hashanah V'Rosh Hashanah Rekan Arba'a Asar. Right? Same thing. One day before Rosh Hashanah, and Rosh Hashanah adds up to 14 days of Shloshim. Okay? And he goes on. Amar Ravina. Okay, Ravina says, Hilkach, therefore, Yomecha bifnei achag, vechag, ushmini shalal, harekhan esrim leachat. Yom. Therefore, by that kind of reasoning, one day before achag, chag, remember, means Sukkot. One day before Sukkot, and Sukkot, and Shmini Atzeret, adds up to 21. Okay, so the one day before the Chag is 7, the Chag of Sukkot is 7, Shmini Atzeret, you see he's drawing the inference, if Rosh Hashanah is 7, then Shmini Atzeret is 7. Okay, in which case, you finish Shmini Atzeret, and you have 21. Okay? And with us, in fact, when you finished Simchat Torah, you have 22. You have 22. So you don't observe, you don't start observing until after Simchat Torah.
You said 1 minute Shiva, and then you start to only 8 days out of the Shloshim.
So you only have 8 days out of Shloshim, correct. That's all you have.
So why does it seem that Torah gets you 28?
Because it's Yom Tov Sheni Shal Galuyot. It's the second day of the holiday for the diaspora. And the diaspora doesn't yield you that much. You don't get that much credit for it. Okay. Okay. Now let's go back just for a moment and reflect on the notion here of Rosh Hashanah. The Tosafot, and it's reflected in the long English note, raise an interesting problem. The problem is, if you have Rosh Hashanah comes and cuts off, cuts 14. Off Yushana, okay? So you got 14 after that. Okay? Then the truth is, really doesn't matter what happens afterwards, because comes Yom Kippur and it cuts off everything. So in a way there are really no practical ramifications for this, except for the fact that the Shiva is cut off. But as far as the Shloshim goes, it really doesn't matter. because anyway there's going to be another holiday in close proximity which is going to cut off the rest of the Shloshim. So it's not as if you can have Shloshim anyway. Okay?
When you get a few days? Or?
Yeah, you get a few days. You'll get a few days. Yeah, right. But you would have anyway. You would have anyway. Okay? Yeah, and when we say that you start, the way we're counting it, you start right before. At an hour before Rosh Hashanah. Came Rosh Hashanah. That's the end of the Shema. Day after Rosh Hashanah, it's now... Okay, that's the 15th day. Okay?
Yeah.
That's the 15th day. So
no, the 15th, because Rosh Hashanah is 2 days.
Oh, you're right. So Rosh Hashanah, you're
so
correct. It's 2 days, actually. It's actually 2 days even in Israel. So then it's the 16th day. All right, how many more days do you have until...
from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur.
From the first day of Rosh Hashanah.
Yeah.
So you have eight more.
Eight.
You have seven more. Seven
yeah,
more because...
Eve, yeah.
Because, right, because you the last one... is going to be Yom Kippur. Okay? Is that right? Yeah, that should be right. So you have seven. So the truth is, if you started observing, well, let's see, what could you do? You have 14, and you have another seven, so it's 21. So comes Yom Kippur, and it cuts off the Shloshim at 21. So you can't really have more. If you're starting when we're starting, you can't have more than that.
Even if you didn't sit 7 days of Shiva.
No, you didn't sit.
You didn't. Well, assuming that you sat an hour. Assuming that you sat an hour. So what the note says is that there are those who say, well, it's only true if you sat a whole 7 days. If you didn't sit 7 days, it's different. I think that all of that is just beside the point.
Do you remember Lem's book that the Yontav only counts as the Shloshim if you sat the full 7 days of Shiva? That if Yontav cut off the Shiva,
because that would be what the Tosafot says.
Yontav cut off the Shiva.
The Yontav
does not cancel.
Well, that's true. Correct. Well, that's always true. If Yontav cancels the Shiva, Yontav will not cancel the Shloshim. The Shloshim continues. Another Yontif comes, okay, and you've already gotten rid of the Shiva one way or another, either by observing it or by having a prior Yontif cut it off, and then the next Yontif will cut that off. Okay? I think that what you see here, in a way, it's this built-in system, the same way as we said that if you can't observe the 7 days of Yom Tov, or if you can observe 7 days, you can never observe the full Shiva anyway, so you might as well cut it off. In a way, this is the same thing. It's the same thing. Because you're never going to be able to observe the full Shloshim with Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. It can't work. Okay? With that kind of timing.
So that was the decision why they made it like that.
That's not what they say. That's my reasoning. That's my chiddush, as it were. I think that's maybe... That makes sense. That is an additional reason why one can treat Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur the same way that one treats all the others as seven. Okay? Because Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur have a uniqueness to them. And that is their proximity to each other. And the fact that if you have one thing cut off with one, the Shloshim will be cut off with the other. Okay? Questions at that? Very good. Ladies and gentlemen, I think we'll call it here and we'll begin with the Mishnah next time.
Thank you. Thank you. My older boy's girlfriend's parents are from Iraq. They left in the 70s.